paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Friday afternoon, the weekend just around the corner. What the heck, it's here. Amina Alahi is in the studio. She writes for Blue Sky Innovation in the Chicago Tribune and has been on the program from time to time. We talk about innovation and what's in Blue Sky on Friday afternoons. Amina, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thank you.
Bring the microphone right up to your face there, if you would. Thank you very much.
How's this?
Oh, it's good. So if you listen to the program regularly, you'll know I started the week with Will Flanagan from Chicago Inno talking about, well, he tried to explain to me how 3D printers work, because it's just something that I haven't quite been able to grasp. And we've been talking about it off the air, and I think I got a little bit better understanding of it. But it seems to be like there's this big race toward 3D printing, but people are sort of buying the race cars before they know how to drive them, right? Is that the kind of the case?
I think that's absolutely right. In at least some cases, there's a lot of hype around this idea of 3D printing and creating something brand new on demand, having the ability to prototype in your office. But depending on what your needs are, it's important to know which machine is the right machine to buy. Some companies maybe invest a lot in a really high-end 3D printer but then don't know how to maintain it, or others may try to go the more affordable route and find out that what they have in the office is not actually capable of what they need.
There's in the story quotes a study that says 3 of every 4 companies that are using 3D printing don't think they're using the technology to its full potential.
That's right. I mean, it's got a lot of potential, obviously, in that it's very flexible. You can iterate on what you're creating. You can do a new design every day if you want, but it's expensive. It can be slow depending on the quality of your machine. And if you don't know how to use it to its full capacity, you're probably not going to get your full investment out of it.
I think it's interesting, too. Another expert said, well, the people who are using these printers need to stop thinking as much like consumers, as people buying a paper printer, as they are creators. I mean, they need to think of this piece of machinery in a whole new way, which I guess is quite a mental exercise.
It is. I mean, you're going from literally 2D to 3D. It's a whole different way of thinking, and there are so many new possibilities that if you don't approach it from that perspective, you know, you're going to miss out.
Right. I remember when the first time I saw a microwave oven, now you're too young for that, but when we went to this, it was my uncle's store, and he's like, look, I'm going to make a cupcake. And then we all stood around and watched this cupcake being made in a microwave. And then we're like, well, what else? I don't know. You know, it's this really cool tool, but we really don't know what's going to come next. And maybe that's where we are with 3D printers right now.
That's possible. And I think there's room for education, certainly, because it's hard to break out of what you already expect and think beyond to what might be possible.
Speaking of education, Northwestern is greatly expanding their computer science department, which surprises me, because I would have thought that would have been an area that would have boomed a long time ago and they'd be at full capacity by now.
Yeah, I mean, well, they are seeing a huge demand for computer science courses. In our story, we have that about half of all undergraduate students are now enrolled in at least one computer science course, which is insane.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're just seeing this demand bubbling up over and over, and Northwestern is planning to add 20 faculty members and invest $150 million over the next 5 years to a department that's only, you know, about 3 years old.
About 345 students majored in computer sciences in the last school year, up from 192 the previous year. So almost double the amount.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I actually went to Northwestern, and I remember colleagues, you know, classmates of mine, rather, who were taking computer science classes and actually went on to found startups and that sort of thing. But very few of them actually had this computer science major. It was more of like a concentration within the engineering school.
Right.
So I think it just goes to show that universities are trying to evolve and not only prepare students for the realities of the job market, but also kind of take advantage of that.
But Amina, why is that? I mean, I can remember 20 years ago, people were saying, oh, you got to study computers. You know what I mean? I mean, it seems like there's been another boomlet or something after the first big wave in the 80s and early 90s.
That's absolutely true. And you're hearing more and more about just the demand for engineers and computer scientists and the fact that there just aren't that many. People want to see more of them. And in fact, I did a story this morning just looking at Chicago Public Schools and their commitment to computer science since they're doing a new high school requirement as of this year. And that just goes to show, I think, that there is such a demand in our economy and that will continue to grow over time, that people are trying to get people involved sooner and sooner in order to meet that demand.
I think, too, I think what's striking about Northwestern is so much of it is interdisciplinary. So it used to be the computer geeks over here and the English majors or the journalism, you know, over there. And now everyone's using computers in one way or another. So whether you're studying English or journalism or whatever it is, you probably aren't taking a computer class as well.
It just goes to show that computer science is essential to any field now.
Right. Okay. Another area that interests me, and Blue Sky writes about it this week, is, you know, the idea of diversity and that different people, getting different people involved, this story has to do with in the money situation when it comes to venture capitalists, how that will change who gets the money. You know, you think that a venture capitalist is looking for a great idea, whether it's from a white guy, a black guy, a black woman, or whomever. But the fact is we just all see the world a little differently. And there's this real movement toward building African-American venture capital, right? That's what's happening at the Urban League?
That's right. And it's not just a matter of seeing the world differently, but it's also a matter of who your networks are. So maybe you know a lot
That's a better point. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's just maybe you're tapped into certain communities because you're a part of them. And so you have exposure to ideas that you might not run into or I might not run into otherwise.
You might be aware of a need that I might not be aware of.
Exactly. It's maybe just easier to understand. You know, the example that comes up a lot is this company called Bevel. It's out of San Francisco. They create shaving tools for African-American men because they have different hair. And the idea, you know, that gets discussed a lot is maybe a Caucasian man would not understand the need for that
product.
Sure,
exactly.
So it's, you know, that's a very obvious example, but there are others as well that you can see might appeal to certain populations or that may be great for the general population, but, you know, it's just a matter of having the right connection to an investor.
So this new movement at the Urban League, and I think the Pritzker Foundation is doing one too, to sort of build these new networks or introduce these new networks?
I think the idea is that empowering minorities and African Americans in particular to invest as angels or as venture capitalists can increase sort of the growth of these minority-led companies simply because they have more access to those communities and they might relate a little more easily to those entrepreneurs.
Something to watch. Amina Alahi from Blue Sky Innovation. Nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, do you like to read ahead? I want to tell you about a story in Sunday's Chicago Tribune, and I'll start with a quote from it. Chicago is a manufacturing town. We make things. The city of big shoulders isn't necessarily the city of laptops. Those are the words of Sonnet Berniker Hart of Koval Distillery. To explain what she was talking about is Greg Trotter, the guy who writes the story. I think it'll be up online at Chicago Tribune a little bit later today. Greg, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Tell me where the city of big shoulders starts to conflict with the city of three flats and four flats and condo developments.
Yeah, so it's sort of interesting. Earlier in early April, the city announced that it was going to undertake this public review process of its 26 industrial corridors, which includes the 15 planned manufacturing districts. And the manufacturing districts are areas of 5 acres or more that prohibit residential development. And these are areas that have been traditionally attractive to breweries and distilleries because
they can spread out a little bit. They're not bothering neighbors, but they're close enough to tourists that the tourists can come in, like to Koval's tasting room or to the Goose Island Brewery along the Clybourne corridor.
Exactly. And so that's an interesting point, because not just any of the PMDs, as they're called, will do. Some of them are pretty far flung in the city, so that, you know, they like the ones that are close into the city, close to the hot neighborhoods. So they're concerned that if you change some of the zoning within these PMDs, it could make it more difficult for them to find affordable manufacturing space here.
And that's what's happening, right? The city is reviewing these PMDs and these, well, what you had a number in here. I got to read. It was a shocking number to me. Today, there are about 180 craft breweries in Illinois, about 80 of which are in Chicago. That's according to Justin Maynard. 4 years ago, there were only 20 craft breweries in the state, about half of them in the city. So
yeah.
You've got 80 microbreweries, and I mean, they're more than just little restaurants on Lincoln Avenue, right? They need some space.
Right. No, not, I mean, that, I thought that number was staggering, too, just to show the growth. I mean, and you know, at a time where, you know, much has been written about the decline of manufacturing jobs in the city, and here you have a slice of industry that's just booming and growing very fast. And yeah, I mean, they're not all small little brew pubs. I mean, the Lagunitas Brewery, for example, on Douglas Park, 300,000 square foot facility, and that's also in a PMD.
Well, so we just got a minute here, Greg, but the city wants to look at this. What's in it for the city? Do they get more tax revenue if they've got residential areas in these PMDs?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the city would, you know, the city says that this is a very, very early in the review process. Nothing has changed yet. There's plenty of areas, even outside of the PMDs, for these breweries and distilleries to set up shop as well. You know, they say that, you know, the breweries and distilleries are the type of industry that they're hoping to, you know, encourage
sure.
investment in these districts. So they're saying, you know, nothing's changed yet. But yeah, I mean, you know, some of these industrial corridors, I think, you know, you clearly need some help and some revitalization. And, you know, if you look at, for example, at the Finkel site there in the Clybourne district, that's sort of central to this conversation. There's, you know, there's going to be a lot more talk about what's going to
Right.
And be built there.
Right now it's manufacturing, but boy, it would be plumb for some residences as well. Well, listen, it's a great story. Going up online, if it's not up yet, it will be up this afternoon, I think, right at ChicagoTribune.com.
Yes, sir.
And in the Chicago Tribune Sunday edition on your driveway Sunday morning. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, imagine the case of a general manager whose star employee is a bit of a renegade. He's a risk taker, always making the big play. And he also keeps score, meaning if he's not happy, he could do more harm than good. That is the C-suite story of George Washington and Benedict Arnold. At least it's my version of it. Nathaniel Philbrick has a more definitive version in his book, Valiant Ambition, and he joins us now. Nat, it's great to see you. Welcome back to Chicago. Welcome to the Business Lunch.
Oh, it's great to be back in Chicago.
Tell me, how was my assessment? Can we make this a business story?
And particularly since for Arnold, it ultimately was all about the money. He began as a seagoing merchant, donated a lot of his personal wealth to the cause, but was not good at managing his own personal finances, and money really ended up driving his ultimate creep towards treason.
I want to talk leadership issues a little bit, but the difference, Benedict Arnold and George Washington were at one point very similar leaders, right, early in the
Absolutely.
War.
Absolutely. They were wired in very similar ways. Both were by temperament aggressive, and I think there's a large part of Washington that was almost envious of Arnold. If he had been 10 years younger and not saddled with the crushing responsibility of command, he could have been Arnold out there winning the victories on the battlefield.
And yet it was Washington who was, or it was Arnold who was more influenced by personal relationships and sort of peer pressure in a way than was George Washington.
Yeah, Washington could get out himself, outside himself, and Arnold was lived in the moment and was very much influenced by those around him. And, you know, if one of his friends was in trouble, he'd take his end and end up in controversy. He was, could be hot-headed.
He would take a risk. I said earlier he would make the big play. Now, as I recall, and maybe this is something you wrote once, but George Washington in the French and Indian War made a big play, right, and came back with his scalpel almost barely intact.
He basically started the French and Indian War,
okay.
And ended up in a very, a very risky situation where a French officer who is basically a diplomatic emissary ends up getting a tomahawk to the skull from one of the, Native warriors accompanying Washington. And, you know, this had huge implications, but it was kind of Washington's style at that time. He was out there and risking it.
So they both are risky early on. Mm-hmm. What changes for Washington?
Well, Washington begins to realize that putting his army at risk in the midst of this Revolutionary War is not for the better interests of his country, that he needs to just survive and, you know, to kind of go with the rope-a-dope rather than knock the guy out. Right. Because if they can just hang in there, they could win this thing.
Was Benedict Arnold a better battlefield general than George Washington?
He had a better record. When he was on the battlefield in those first years of the Revolution, inevitably he would come out, you know, if not victorious, doing way beyond what he should have been able to do given his paltry resources.
Tell me about the battle of, is it Valcourt Island?
Valcourt Island.
And Lake Champlain.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest sea battles that no one knows about, fought on Freshwater Lake, Lake Champlain, and it was absolutely critical because this was 1776. Washington had lost New York to the British, invasionary forces coming down from Canada, and Arnold is between that force and America basically losing the war. And he fights them to a draw, this big group of British warships with just 15 boats he had hacked out of the trees surrounding the wilderness of the lake, and he does it because he's aggressive, he's smart, and he pulls it off. And, you know, you could say that he was the one who saved America in 1776.
Okay, let me put it this way. Let me put it in suburban terms. He sort of hides in a cul-de-sac.
Yeah. Well, what he does is he knows that the British ships can't sail upwind effectively and that a northerly breeze will be bringing them down the lake. He hides his fleet inside a little island where there's a small bay, Valcourt Island, and he waits for them to sail past, then sticks out his head and waves, "Here I am." They assume they've got him trapped, but they are the ones that are sailing into a trap.
And then later he's trapped again, or he's pinned in, right? And he sneaks out in the middle of the night? Tell me that.
Yeah, well, he fights them to a draw. Night comes, and the British say, aha, we've got him trapped in this little bay because he can't escape to the north. They put a line of ships across. There's a big fog that night. Everybody's deaf because they've been shooting cannons for 8 hours. And he says, we're going to go through these guys. And he's able to sneak his entire fleet through the British line. The British commander wakes up the next morning, and there's no fleet there. He's apoplectic.
All right, let's go back to the human resources offices then of the Revolutionary War.
Yes.
We've got Arnold, who does well, has successes,
yep.
But he's not sort of liked by the board of directors, right? He has trouble with the Congress and others.
Well, the Congress overlooks him for promotion, which upset Arnold.
Not just once, right? I mean, there are five people.
Not once, but, you know, and then they give him sort of a promotion, but not the full thing. And he's bitter about that. And you know, he's got a thin skin. And he expects his own country to shower him with praise. And it's not forthcoming.
He's got a thin skin and a young loyalist wife.
Yes.
It goes back to who he's influenced by.
Right. You know, by this time, he's suffered a great victory and a terrible physical loss at Saratoga. He's in Philadelphia, that's full of infighting, and he's miserable, but he's fallen in love with this beautiful 18-year-old girl, literally half his age, Peggy Shippen, and she's comes from an aristocratic family and really loved it when the British occupied Philadelphia and has contacts among the British officer corps. And within a month of their marriage, Arnold sends his first feelers to one of Peggy's good friends, Major John Andre, in British-occupied New York.
So I know I'm torturing this a little bit, but is this a management issue? I mean, had the managers treated Benedict Arnold a little differently when they kept him?
To a certain extent. And you have to perhaps fault Washington, because Arnold was terribly injured at Saratoga, and it would be a year before he could walk, 2 years before he could ride a horse. He couldn't be in active field command. So Washington said, I'll make you military commander of war-torn Philadelphia. And that required someone with tact, patience, not Arnold.
So bad management decision.
Bad management decision, because it basically drove him into even more bitterness and ultimately treason.
Washington was one of the last to still believe in him.
Yeah. Well, you know, Washington wasn't alone. This guy was a hero, and it was hard for anyone to conceive of someone who had been at such heights stooping to turning his back on everything he once held sacred. And his treason caught the entire American military off guard.
We should say his treason was he planned to give up West Point. Now, as it turned out, Andre was caught, and he didn't quite get away with it. He was a hero. He was a great general, and yet he's vilified today.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons you wrote the book. Your mother was a fan of Benedict Arnold,
yes.
Right?
My mother was a renegade. When I was growing up in the 60s, my mom smoked a pipe. She just did what she wanted to. And Benedict Arnold appealed to her. There was something, the outrageousness, the audacity of him appealed to her. And she always said he got a bum rap. And I have to admit, Mom had a point.
She was right?
Yeah, she was right.
About most things or just this?
Most things, I'll diplomatically say.
But what I like is the idea, and you've spoken of this, that in the early 18th century, this country was in search of a Genesis story.
Yeah.
And we had the hero. George Washington was going to be the hero. And, subconsciously or unconsciously or maybe consciously, they sought out the villain.
Yes. You need
and it was Benedict Arnold.
Right. We needed a creation story. We had deserted basically from the British Empire. We were a nation of traitors. And it was ironically Arnold's treason that gave us the story land. We had the hero, Washington. Now we had the villain, Benedict Arnold.
Let's go to the movies for a second. In the Heart of the Sea was a holiday release.
Yes.
Your book.
Yeah.
I always love the authors because they, it's their baby. They create this, and then they have to let it go.
Right.
And you had to let that go. How was the experience for you?
Well, it was 13 years in coming. So
I put it off to college, maybe. Yeah.
Right. Well, it got optioned. I had assumed it was in the dust heap of cinematic history. Yeah. It wasn't going to happen. And then Chris Hemsworth and Ron Howard attached themselves to it. And working with Ron Howard was just amazing.
Nice.
He's everything you could ever think. And it's a movie, and it's Hollywood's take on my book, and I really enjoyed it. And it's his own thing. And if people see it and they want to read the book, great.
Will Bunker Hill be next?
We'll see. It's been optioned, and apparently a screenplay is being written. And I'm patient. It took me 13 years with the other one. So
we'll
see.
Keep writing the books, and we'll keep reading those. Nathaniel Philbrick, the name of the book, Valiant Ambition. Great to talk to you again.
Oh, great to talk to you again.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson, Kim Gordon, and Jill Egan as well. Steve Bertrand here. We're winding down on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Friday, which means the weekend is dead ahead. Philip Weiss is in the studio, the principal at Seyfarth Shaw at Work. Welcome back to the Business Lunch, Philip.
Good to see you, Steve.
There's been stories this week, and I thought of you right away when I was reading these stories about people suing over the Americans with Disabilities Act, whether you're visually impaired or whatever, it's the sort of thing that businesses really have to deal with. And we had a conversation, I think one of our first together, about this and about how hard it is for businesses to, just how they deal with it. Because on the one hand, the ADA is very important. I'm a big supporter, but there are also people who go out and try to sue when they're not necessarily offended. So tell me a little bit about the balance when it comes to business and the ADA.
Yeah, well, I think you framed it perfectly, Steve, because on the one hand, we've got all kinds of situations where with a couple of simple steps, a company could do a lot better in terms of serving individuals with disabilities. We actually helped a company. They operated a fleet of ice cream trucks, and one of their ice cream truck drivers set himself up about two blocks away from a group home. Mm-hmm. A lot of people living there had cognitive disabilities, visual disabilities. What they asked him for when they approached the truck was to read the selection of ice creams. But in a rush to serve the other customers, he gave them three or four choices, said, "That's all I have," and that was that. They soon realized that they were missing about 80% of the ice cream fare. The guy was also located, Steve, next to a courthouse. So he actually had something called a courthouse cone. Uh-huh. Very popular item. So there was no dearth of attorneys willing to take the case. That's the one hand. But you're right. On the other hand, you've got this real rash of lawsuits filed by people who either saw a missing ramp, saw a lack of accessible parking space, or just decided they should sue to push the process along.
Okay, so when it comes to judging the public good, as we are the judges of the public good here in the studio, Is there value to that? Is there value to seeking out offenses, even if there's not necessarily harm, to prevent harm in the future?
Yeah, well, there's no one answer to that, but the short answer is those cases are here to stay. The last 20 years, it was the big companies that were being sued. The real trend now, Steve, is the mom and pop shop,
right,
meaning
right.
It is someone who says, I've lived here my whole life, and I don't think I can access that facility. But beyond that, there are people that are professional serial plaintiffs. One gentleman has sued 500 companies on these kinds of cases.
500 different suits, this guy.
500, including in Illinois.
Is he after cash, or is he after making things better?
So if you talk to him and the plaintiff's firm...
Okay, don't finish that. Is he getting cash?
He actually, that gentleman is likely getting cash.
Okay, then I made my decision.
Okay, well, maybe it did.
Yeah.
But I think if you held him under oath and you asked him to swear, he would say he's making changes for the good of the community. The interesting thing is, because the ADA allows recovery of attorney's fees, and those can be $10,000, $15,000, a lot of the 500 companies would rather pay $5,000 or $4,000 to make the case go away. That's where someone like that one gentleman can make money from this process.
I see. So he'll go to the company and say, I'll sue you. You can go to court, or you can pay me for less than what you'd pay your lawyers.
Exactly. Plus, and this is the part that makes your judgment, your moral judgment, difficult. They're going to have to install that ramp,
yeah.
Or they're going to have to widen that access to the goods.
Let's go back to the mom and pop shops then, because for me, it's like you have to prepare for the unknowable in a way. I mean, how do you cover yourself, you know, in a good-hearted way for something that you might not know is coming, or that you might not a deficit that you might not even recognize?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So on the one hand, when it comes to access, because we're talking about, you know, people, also places, services, things,
sure.
you want to look ahead. There are some really easy-to-use checklists that you can take and apply to the entrance of your place of business. How do people access the goods? If they can't reach them, can someone help them get the goods? So there are ways to plan ahead that are cost effective. On the other hand, though, if you're facing a situation, you don't want to rush to judgment. There was a company we worked with because they had a moving van, and they arrived at a woman's home. They learned while she was outside that she had hepatitis C. The decision was made immediately. We're not moving her stuff anymore. That's a bloodborne disease.
Right.
If you go to the CDC website, Steve, moving a furniture is not an actual transmission vehicle for hepatitis C. Needles are usually involved.
Right.
So the other answer to your question is you want to take a moment when you confront an ADA-type issue. Can we accommodate the person? Can we adjust our services? What will our standard be?
That's Philip Weiss. More at Seyfarth Shaw at Work. SEYFARTH.
That's right.
Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.